Hey everyone, John here from Fly8MikeAlpha.com, and today we are getting into Area of Operation 1 of the Private Pilot ACS, talking about Task A, Pilot Qualifications. Now, the references for this section are going to be Part 61, Part 68, and Part 91, as well as some of the other FAA handbooks and advisory circulars. Now, really, all you need to know here for this section truly is Part 61 as it applies to private pilots. So if you read that first part of Part 61, that's going to be 61.1 through 61.60, subpart A. So subpart A is 61.1 through 61.60, and then subpart E, ECHO, deals specifically with private pilots. That is 61.102 to 61.120, which is not actually a reg or anything really. 61.117 is the end of subpart E. So again, 61.1 through 61.60 and 61.102 through 61.117, 61.117. Those are the sections we really want you to focus on here. If you're familiar with those, you will be in good shape for the checkride. Now, that is the references for this section. Let's talk objective. They want to determine that you, the applicant, exhibits satisfactory knowledge, risk management, and skills associated with airmen and medical certificates, including privileges, limitations, currency, and operating as pilot in command as a private pilot. So the idea here with the knowledge section is they want you to demonstrate that you know the certification requirements. So how many hours does it take to become a private pilot? Do you meet all those requirements? Is it all in your logbook? What did your CFI have to teach you? That's all in Part 61 as well in that subpart E section. Then recent flight experience and record keeping. So obviously you need your flight review every 24 calendar months. You need to log in your logbook anything you're going to use to be legally current. So you don't have to log every single flight. So you go for a nice Saturday afternoon sunset flight, you don't have to log. That's not a requirement, but you do need to log it if you plan to use that for currency purposes to show that you are legally current for your three takeoffs and landings every 90 days if you're going to be carrying passengers. And then, of course, the flight review every 24 calendar months that is required. Now, the specifics of the three takeoffs and landings every 90 days, that is the whole, you need to do three touch and goes every 90 days if you're going to carry passengers. And that would be if you're in a nose wheel airplane. Now, if you're in a tail wheel airplane, you have to do three full stop landings or three stop and goes or three landings to a full stop every 90 days to be able to carry passengers in a tail wheel airplane. And they do have to be to a full stop even in a nose wheel airplane if you're going to be counting them for night currency. So if you're going to be flying with passengers at night, and the definition here for night is the time from 1 hour after sunset to 1 hour before sunrise. The true definition of nighttime per the FAA is from civil twilight until civil twilight, so usually around a half hour or so after sunset or whenever civil twilight is until about a half hour or so before sunrise. That's when you can legally log night flight time, but for the purpose of logging a night landing, that would be the 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise, and those have to be to a full stop as well if you're going to be carrying passengers 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise. So you can say you're not legally night current, all right? So you haven't done those three full stop landings at night or, you know, 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise in the past 90 days. If you haven't done those, well, can you fly with passengers past sunset? Sure, up to 59 minutes past sunset. And you could legally log night flight time because we start logging night flight time after civil twilight. So say sunset's 5 p.m., civil twilight's maybe 5:25 p.m. So we get to log night flight time for a few minutes, then we land at 5:45 p.m. Well, we don't have to be legally night current, although it would be smart to be. We don't legally have to because it's within that first 59 minutes after sunset, so we can still carry the passengers without legal night currency, and we can actually log night flight time for a few minutes there. Not until you hit 60 minutes after sunset do you need to have your night currency landings done, those three full stop landings, 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise. Now, moving on to the next part of the knowledge section, privileges and limitations. So what can you and can you not do as a private pilot? Well, you can't get paid as a private pilot. And if you want to split the cost of your flying, that's fine, but it can't be more than the pro rata share. So you can never get more than the pro rata share. Let's say it costs you $100 an hour to rent the airplane. You go fly for an hour with a friend. Well, you guys can split it, but he can't be giving you $51 or $75 or paying for it. If there's four people on board the airplane, well, maybe you only chip in $25 or $26 or something, and they chip in the rest. So they can pay more than half of it, but not more than the pro rata share. So it's always got to be divided up evenly. You need to be paying at least that, maybe a little more. So the best answer on a check ride, right, is always going to be, well, you know, I would pay $50.01 and he would pay $49.99. Or if we had four people on board the aircraft, I would pay $25.01 for that $100 flight and they would pay the rest. But you're always going to pay at least your pro rata share for that. If you really want to dive into privileges and limitations like crazy, well, that's going to be 61.113. That explains it all in the FAA legal speak of all the privileges and limitations that apply specifically to you, a private pilot. Now, talking about medical certificates, class expiration privileges, temporary disqualifications. So as it pertains to medical certificates, well, 61.23 is what we would like to look at there. That tells us how long each medical certificate is good for. Of course, your third class, if you're under 40, is good for 60 months. If you're over 40, it's good for 24 months. And not if you're over 40 or under 40 is actually the rule. The rule is, what was your age at the date of examination? So if you got your third class medical when you were 39 and 9 months old, just before your 40th birthday, well, in fact, it's good for 60 calendar months, all right? Even though you're over 40 now, you still have 60 calendar months. It's based on the date of examination. Now, if you get a second class medical, it's good for 12 months as a second class, and then reverts, it takes 12 months off of whatever you would have had if it was a third class. So now you'd have either 4 years remaining at the third class level if you were under 40 at the time of examination, or if you were over 40 at the time of examination, well, you would have 1 year remaining, 12 calendar months remaining at the third class level. And for first class medical certificates, if you were over 40 at the time of examination, well, then you would have 6 months at the first class, 6 months at second class, and 12 months third class. If you were under 40 at the time of exam for your first class medical, you would get 12 months first class. You would bypass second class altogether, and it would be 4 more years, 48 more months available at the third class level. So if there's any confusion on that, 61.23 is where you can reference that. Any questions that pertain to temporary disqualifications? Hey, I started taking this new medication. Am I still legal to fly? Or, you know, I broke my toe. Am I still okay? Is my medical still valid? Always defer those questions to an AME, your aviation medical examiner doctor. Say, hey, you know, that's a great question. I'm not sure if I can fly with a broken toe. I would call my aviation doctor, my AME. And really, you don't have to have the right answer on the day of your private pilot check ride. You just have to know where you're going to look for the information. Have a satisfactory answer for that. And a good satisfactory answer for these weird medical questions is, hey, I would just call my aviation doctor, not my family doctor, but if they give me some sort of medication or I got some allergies or whatever, I'd call my aviation doctor, tell them what meds somebody else gave me or what I started taking over the counter and see what they say if I'm still legal to fly. And if they were unsure, well, we could always call Oklahoma City, call the FAA medical branch together. We can find that phone number on Google for the FAA medical examiner, and they can help us out in Oklahoma City with that question. Moving on here to documents required to exercise private pilot privileges. What do you have to have on your person? Well, that's going to be your pilot certificate, a government-issued photo ID, and your medical certificate. Nothing else. You don't have to have your logbook. So just as far as your personal documents, your pilot certificate, a government-issued photo ID, and your medical certificate, the only other document you may ever need is if you're flying internationally, you would need to have your radio operator's license on you as well if you're going to be flying to the Bahamas, Mexico, or Canada. But for within the United States, just those three documents: pilot certificate, government-issued photo ID, and medical certificate. Now, getting into Part 68, Basic Med Privileges and Limitations, we're going to come back to that in a second because not everyone has to deal with basic med, so we're going to leave that out for now. We will come back to that in a separate file, so those of you who are not going to be getting your basic med certificate, if you're a little bit younger or you're planning to go on the career track and you already have a second class or your first class medical and you're not doing basic med, well, then you can skip past that, but we'll come back to that for everyone else who wants to learn more about basic med in a later file after this one. Skipping down to the risk management part here, we have what they're looking for is that you, the applicant, demonstrates the ability to identify, assess, and mitigate risks encompassing, first part here, failure to distinguish proficiency versus currency. This is a big one on your private pilot check ride. What is the difference between proficiency and currency. Well, currency is what you legally need to do to be current, all right, to be legal to go fly the airplane. So the bare minimums for you to be legal is currency. They say, well, if you get your private pilot certificate today and you don't fly for 18 months, you can still go fly by yourself without flying with an instructor or anything legally because you're within that 24-month window for your flight review. So as long as your medical is still valid and all that good stuff, well, then you can go out and you can go start doing touch-and-goes on your own or do your 3 touch-and-goes, and then you could go take passengers up flying during the day, and that would be currency. But you're probably not proficient if you just got your license today and haven't flown for 18 months now into the future. You're probably not proficient. You're probably not ready to go fly the airplane safely. And that is the difference between proficiency and currency. So currency is the bare minimums for legality. Proficiency is what you really should be doing to be safe. And how could you be proficient if you hadn't flown in 18 months? Well, you call up your flight instructor and say, hey, I can't believe it's been 18 months since I passed my private pilot check ride and I haven't flown. And I'd like to go take my girlfriend flying this weekend. So what can I do? And, you know, can you go fly with me and get me current again? And then we use that term current, but you're already current, really. But the true term you should be using is, could you get me proficient again? So you go out for 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 flight lessons. You get proficient again. You get safe again. And then you can go fly on your own, exercising those legal privileges. The next part of risk management here they have is flying unfamiliar airplanes or operating with unfamiliar flight display systems and avionics. So congratulations, you as a private pilot have your certificate for private pilot airplane single engine land. Really, any airplane single engine land, you can go fly as long as you have the endorsements for it, if it's high performance or complex. But you could fly a 172 or a 152 or any different airplane. You could jump into a Cherokee 140 without any additional endorsements or any additional training from a legal standpoint, not from a safe proficiency standpoint. And this is why it's on the risk management side of things. They say, hey, it's awful risky for you to jump into a Piper Cherokee when all you've ever flown is a Cessna 172. So what are you going to do in this case? You know, we give you your license today and your buddy says, hey, why don't you take up my Piper Cherokee? It's a great airplane. It's real easy to fly. What would you do there, Jim? And Jim, your answer should be on your private pilot check ride, well, that's an unfamiliar airplane and I would have to go find a flight instructor to fly with me a couple times in that thing and give me a proper checkout and some instruction in it to make sure I'm safe in it. What about you've been flying a 172 and now there's a different 172, but it's got crazy different radios or avionics or anything. Really, honestly, anytime you switch end numbers, even if it's the same exact model airplane, same 172, but it's a different physical aircraft, different end number, you should be getting some instruction in it. And that's what they identify here. If you're operating with unfamiliar flight display systems or avionics, or really anytime you're switching aircraft, you need to get some instruction in it. And this is what you want to express to the examiner when you're sitting there on your oral, he knows that you know you need to do this. So you say, oh, wow, you know, that's a great scenario you gave me there that I could go fly somebody else's airplane and it's got, you know, a beautiful glass cockpit in it, but I'm unfamiliar with that. So again, I would have to call up my flight instructor and see if he could go fly with me and give me some instruction in that airplane so I would be safe. Now, lastly, here we have the skills. The skills are to determine that you, the applicant, demonstrates the ability to apply requirements to act as PIC, pilot in command, under visual flight rules in a scenario given by the evaluator. And that would be similar to the scenario that we just gave you there of switching different airplanes, or perhaps, hey, you know, you get your license today, you haven't flown at all for 6 months, and you need to go take your parents flying at night. You know, sunset is 6 p.m., and you're going to take your parents flying at 7:30 p.m. What do you have to do? Or, hey, you get your license today, you're going to go take your parents flying, sunset is 6 p.m., you take off at 5:30 and land at 6:30, civil twilight was 6:25, and you did 3 touch-and-goes earlier that day before you took your parents flying. Was that a legal flight? Well, yes, it was, because you landed within 59 minutes after sunset, even though you hadn't done your 3 full-stop landings 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise within the preceding 90 days. If they gave you the same scenario, but you were landing at 7:05 p.m., well, then you would need to have done those 3 takeoffs and landings in the past 90 days, 1 hour after sunset or 1 hour before sunrise, which in that case, it sounds like you'd probably have to delay that flight or go out the day before that and get those 3 takeoffs and landings to a full stop done by yourself. But again, although you might be current to do that, to go out and become even more current to fly at night all on your own, it's not necessarily that you're proficient to go fly at night. So in the interest of safety, you'd probably want to take your CFI along to get current with him on board or her on board to help you. And again, always in the interest of safety, expressing to the examiner you're going to make good safe decisions on your own when you get out there. That is it for task A in pre-flight preparation. We'll see you back here for task B when we talk about airworthiness requirements.